Don't spend another winter with your home colder than it should be. Hi, I'm Roy Spencer with PermaSeal. We measure the amount of heat loss and recommend solutions to keep it comfortable. Call PermaSeal for your free estimate, 800-421-SEAL, or visit permaseal.net.
And so it begins.
And now, here with an unlimited supply of misinformation, is Mr. Know-It-All.
John, I love your show.
All right, let's get rolling now. It's 109 live from the Allstate Showcase Studio on Michigan Avenue. Hi, it's John Williams. How are you? We're here until 3, and we hope you are too. In this hour, we'll talk a little bit about Chuck Berry's story. I don't know it that well. I know I'm supposed to know it pretty well. Jim DeRogatis will walk us through some of that at 1:30. Our Trump Talk segment always falls in the 2 o'clock hour, and there's lots to do with the hearings which are going on today. Just fascinating those things can be if you have the time and patience to sit down and watch and listen to them. I did, and so we'll talk about that with ABC, what we have learned and have not learned. And that's in the 2 o'clock hour today. And we'll also talk a little bit about what happened to Northwestern, because that was a crime! Just to preview what we're going to do in the 2 o'clock hour, and to give you a sense of what it was like if you weren't able to listen to it much, the hearings that have been taking place, you know, the Democrats show their side, and the Republicans obviously have their angle as well. Much of the time, whichever congressman was talking to Schiff or Comey or Rogers, either of them would say things like, you know, I'm just not at liberty to discuss that. Thank you. Somebody's welcoming me back. Neither of them were at liberty to discuss it much. So oftentimes the answer is, well, I just won't comment on that. And not because it would be a breach of security, although sometimes that was the case, but often the two people that were testifying today, the NSA and the FBI, were saying that they would not comment because they do not want to validate reports in the media. They say, if we do say, well, yeah, that one was true, then we're going down that road and we're not going to be the scorekeepers. He said it's very frustrating, but there are times where stuff will be in the newspapers and we know it's not true, but we will not say that because we can't jump in and out and have people interpret when we say what we say, right? Because if they knock something down but then don't later, well, then we'll all assume it's true. And they said, we're not going to go on record. We're not going to help the media. He said, it's very frustrating, though, at times when something gets said and we know it's not true, but we're not going to further the story in one direction or another. That's not our job. In fact, that might work against the best interests of our job. Interesting point. But then you can imagine how frustrating it is for, say, the FBI or the CIA or the NSC or any of these, the NSA, if they see something going on and they know it's not true and we're all getting wrapped up about it, and they just sit on it. And more than once he said, I'm not going to comment. Both of them did. I won't comment on your question because I don't want to further the discussion in either direction. But the headline was when Congressman Schiff was talking to James Comey and he was asking him about those 4 famous tweets. There's several cuts we'll play in our 2 o'clock hour, but to just give you a sense of it, this is maybe already the most famous of them.
But there is evidence, is there not, of a break-in of the Democratic headquarters by a foreign power using cyber means?
Yes, there was. As the intelligence community report...
No, I don't know where it went. Okay, so let's try it again. And we want the one Schiff to Comey tapping the tapping of Obama. Go ahead and hit that, Olive.
I want to begin by attempting to put to rest several claims made by the president about his predecessor, namely that President Obama wiretapped his phones. So that we can be precise, I want to refer you to exactly what the president said and ask you whether there is any truth to it. First, the president claimed, quote, terrible. Just found out that Obama had my wires tapped in Trump Tower just before the victory. Nothing found. This is McCarthyism, unquote. Director Comey, was the president's statement that Obama had his wires tapped in Trump Tower a true statement?
With respect to the president's tweets about alleged wiretapping directed at him by the prior administration, I have no information that supports those tweets, and we have looked carefully inside the FBI. The Department of Justice has asked me to share with you that the answer is the same for the Department of Justice and all its components. The department has no information that supports those tweets.
The president accused Mr. Obama and presumably the FBI of engaging in McCarthyism. As you understand the term McCarthyism, do you think President Obama or the FBI was engaged in such conduct?
I'm not going to try and characterize the tweets themselves. All I can tell you is we have no information that supports them.
Were you engaged in McCarthyism, Director Comey?
Try very hard not to engage in any isms of any kind, including McCarthyism.
Yeah, I remember when he said that, when he tweeted that, and I always thought that this isn't McCarthyism we're talking about here. It's more Watergate. It's Nixonism, if you will, what may or may not be taking place. But anyway, in the 2 o'clock hour, we'll talk more about that. In a little while, we'll visit with Jim DeRogatis from the Sun Times about Chuck Berry. I just want to read to you a little bit about his wiki today. They do have the end date. October 18th, 1926, born. Died March 18th, 2017, was an American guitarist, singer, songwriter, and one of the pioneers of rock and roll music, with songs such as Maybelline in 1955, Roll Over Beethoven 1956, Rock and Roll Music in 57, and Johnny B. Goode in 58. Berry refined and developed rhythm and blues into the major elements that made rock and roll distinctive. Born into a middle-class African-American family in St. Louis, Berry had an interest in music from an early age and gave his first public performance at Sumner High School. While still a high school student, he was convicted of armed robbery and was sent to a reformatory where he was held from 1944 to 1947. After his release, Berry settled into married life and worked at an automobile assembly plant. By early 1953, influenced by guitar riffs and showmanship techniques of the blues musician T-Bone Walker, Berry began performing with the Johnny Johnson Trio. His break came when he traveled to Chicago in May of 1959 and met Muddy Waters, who suggested that he contact Leonard Chess of Chess Records. With Chess, he recorded Maybelline, which reached number one on Billboard magazine's Rhythm and Blues chart. By the end of the 1950s, Berry was an established star, but in 1962, he was sentenced to 3 years in prison for offenses under the Mann Act. He had transported a 14-year-old girl across state lines. There's more to that story than that. In 1963, Berry had several more hits, including No Particular Place to Go, You Never Can Tell, and Nadine, but these did not achieve the same success or lasting impact of his 50s songs. And by the 1970s, he was more in demand as a nostalgia performer. His insistence on being paid in cash led in 1979 to a four-month jail sentence and community service for tax evasion. Berry was among the first musicians to be inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame when they opened that in 1986. How'd your brackets do over the weekend? Mine aren't good. And our 2 o'clock hour will also talk about should there be some way for the NCAA basketball tournament to correct a call as egregiously bad as the Gonzaga goaltending. I wasn't watching that in real time, but my phone blows up. Ron Cox is a friend of mine, and he said, are you going to talk about this? And I said, talk about what? And I literally had, I forget where I was, but I know where I was. I was driving around, and I wasn't able to listen to the radio. I was in somebody's house. Anyway, he said, I hope you're going to talk about this. And I said, what? And he said, really bad calls. And there may have been bad calls, but clearly there was an unconscionably bad call late in that game, which led to a technical and maybe a 5-point swing, may have cost him the game, maybe it didn't, right? But how can you fix that? I have not been a fan of instant replay in any sport. I think that particularly in baseball, you got 162 games, that's enough time to determine who's the best player. But in the NCAA tournament, right, with each game being a one and done, only 64 teams, at least late in a game, there ought to be a way for the opposing coach to throw a red flag onto the field and say, okay, I want to look at that. There's got to be a way to fix that. We'll talk about that in the 2 o'clock hour. But about your brackets, there are no perfect brackets of any kind left in America. Only one bracket out of the tens of millions filled out across NCAA.com Bleacher Report's brackets, the ones at CBS, ESPN, and Fox Sports, and the ones on Yahoo, of all of those brackets, only one even made it unscathed through most of Saturday. Just one prescient user on Yahoo picked the tournament's first 39 games correctly, including upsets by number 12 Middle Tennessee State. They had the Xavier win. They had USC winning. They had number 11 Rhode Island winning. Despite correctly predicting number 8 Wisconsin would upset number 1 Villanova on Saturday afternoon, the user streak ended later that evening on the tournament's 40th game when number 5 Iowa State fell to Purdue number 4. They had Iowa State winning that game. Don't feel too bad, though. Not even the best bracketeer of the year predicted number 2 Duke would be upset by number 7 South Carolina on Sunday. I just want to say this about that game. I watched the Duke game yesterday as well, South Carolina. Duke was desperate to win. They fight so furiously, and their coach just completely loses his mind. Mike Krzyzewski today is not the Mike Krzyzewski a lot of us came to love of old.
He's still a great coach, though, John. Uh-oh. Don't you think?
Krzyzewski?
Yeah.
You're a Dukie?
No, I'm not. I'm a huge Louisville fan, but
I've heard him
speak a couple times, and yep. I just think he's a great guy.
I do. I think he's a good coach, and I think he's, at the end of the day, in fact, I thought about this when I was watching the Louisville game, because after the game, you could tell the coach was talking to the players about how they have to think. I thought great coaches are really great teachers. You know what I mean? It's not mm-hmm. just basketball. It's molding young men. It's teaching them to learn. And it's reminding them that, for instance, in the Louisville game, Pitino's point to his players was, you guys want to win so badly. You're so desperate to do anything to win that you will try and create offense when it's not there. And
they fell apart.
And
that's
right.
They just fell apart.
That's what and that's not smart. So regardless of the talent you have or the desire, I'm not going to judge your heart, but you need to be smarter for us to win. And I thought, wow, talk about your teachable moments. And I think Krzyzewski has a lot of that in him too. But I think Krzyzewski's just bananas anymore. And that Duke game, this really isn't a reflection on Krzyzewski. It's more my pet peeve with basketball. That Duke-South Carolina game yesterday turned into tackle football with free throw shooting contests at the end of each down. It was so rough. There were some plays that were astonishingly physical that didn't get called, and then some that, by comparison, were ticky-tack, and then it's free-throw shootings.
I think a lot of these games have seemed really rough to me.
Oh, my gosh, I know it. And it's just because so much is on the line, and some of these teams haven't faced each other. Some of them have really different styles. But as a person who loves basketball, evidently you feel this way too, I hate to see the games devolve into tackle football and free throw shooting. And
I agree.
That's what that game
I love the fast pace, the back and forth,
yes.
shoot.
You yes.
know, that's what I love about college basketball. That's what I grew up on. That's why I've never been a big, huge NBA fan, because I just love the fast pace of college basketball. And I feel like the NBA, they don't even start playing till the fourth quarter.
It really does feel like the first half is a warm-up in the NBA. That's for sure. So, no perfect brackets left. One person got 39 in a row. I'm John Williams. This is WGN. WGN, this is John Williams. Kim's got your news here in just a second. By the way, Ro Khan's back. I haven't seen Ro, but I've seen some of the members of the staff who were with him.
And they're all tan, and it's disgusting.
God. I know. You know, they should really not do that. That is, walk around with their beautiful tans
and
bright white
mean?
Smiles. Would it kill him to put a little white paint on, or, I don't know, just not be around us pasty white people?
No kidding.
Jackie was just all aglow. Jackie has beautiful skin and color anyway, but it's a little darker still. And they're all just chatting away. We had so much fun. So you'll hear some of that with Ro this afternoon, starting at 3 here on WGN. This was in the Chicago Sun Crimes over the weekend. It's a Mick Dumke, Fred Spielman story, and I was kind of confused by it. Cubs shootings lifted cops' budget. It's a story about how when the Cubs won the World Series last year, the amount of overtime the police had to work came to, and city services, almost $19 million. You and I paid the cops, the firefighters, streets and sand, $19 million extra dollars because the Cubs won the World Series. So the question becomes, well, who should pay that, us or the Cubs? The Cubs remind everybody that by winning the World Series, that is having that many games in the postseason, They generated at least $38 million for the city. Restaurants, bars, ticket sales. And that doesn't even include taxes on these items. So, you know, if you had your druthers, you'd happily spend the 19 to make double that, the 38. But they actually reached out to the Cubs, and the Cubs said, no, we're not going to pay that. And I don't think that the city should. Kim, what's your informed opinion on that one? Should the city pay the $19 million, or should we ask the Cubs to pick up the tab on some of that?
Well, I read the article also, and I think what also hit me was just that the huge overtime year that we had in the city, just because, but most of it was due to the violence. It would have been very nice if the Cubs pitched in, but I guess they're not obligated. I mean, you know, it is the city's, you know,
obligation
to keep everyone safe and the garbage picked up. And I mean, we do have parades. We do have other things going on throughout the year that the city doesn't charge other people for. But I think that number also didn't even cover the parade number, did it?
No,
I thought
it did.
There was an addition. Oh, it did. Okay.
I'll double check that. But I thought that included the parade cost. And by the way, a lot of garbage after the parade.
A lot of garbage.
Holy cow. What were you? I know there aren't garbage cans handy.
And it got picked up so quickly, though.
It was pretty cool. I know. It was fascinating to see. But here's what happened. Everybody lined Michigan Avenue and all the streets along the route. And some of them were there for hours. And there weren't garbage cans handy. But I still don't know where you go from, gee, this is inconvenient, to, I think I'll just throw it in the street. But you do. And then as soon as the last vehicle on the parade came by, here came some pooper scoopers and some sweepers and just zoom. You know, that thing was cleaned up within minutes.
It was amazing.
It was amazing. It's hard to believe that was expensive.
Did that article say, and I don't remember, did the Blackhawks pick up any of the tab for all of their rallies and parades?
I don't think they did.
See, I don't think so either. So, I mean, fair is fair.
Yeah,
you know.
That's kind of, listen, you're right, though. In a year where there was so much violence and so much overtime, that's the real story. It'd be nice if the Cubs said, okay, here's $19 million, we're good. But I'm not mad at them for not doing that. You may have an opinion about that. Maybe we'll get to that a little later on. It's time for the news. That's next on WGN.
Maybelline.
How fun is this?
Why can't you be true? Oh, Maybelline. Why can't you be true?
You're popping like a...
You just started doing the things you used to do.
My head's popping up and down like popcorn.
I was motivating over the hill. I saw Maybelline in a coupe ville. A Cadillac rolling on an open road. Nothing out of run my vehicle. A Cadillac doing about 95. Bumper to bumper rolling side to side. Maybelline, why can't you be true? Oh, Maybelline.
Chuck Berry passed away over the weekend, and we're still talking about it this afternoon here on WGN. John Williams at 138. Jim DeRogatis joins us, rock critic for the Chicago Sun-Times. Hey, Jim, it's John Williams. How are you?
John, it's a real pleasure to be talking to you again.
Yeah, we haven't visited in a while. Are you still at South by Southwest, or is that over now?
No, I got back on the weekend, and I've been dealing with Chuck Berry ever since.
So what should we do first? Because I do want to talk to you about South by Southwest. You want to do Chuck Berry first or South by Southwest first?
Yeah, let's talk about Chuck. I mean, there is no South by Southwest. There is no rock and roll whatsoever, John, without the sounds that Chuck recorded at 2120 South Michigan, including Maybelline there.
You know, so I understand, and yet I don't always see the connection. When I listen to Chuck Berry, it doesn't sound to me like what I call rock and roll, at least not these days.
Oh, well, there's a couple of things, John. I mean, number one, let's not forget Jerry Lee Lewis and Fats Domino. It was not a given in the early days of rock and roll that the guitar would be the main instrument.
Hmm.
So, you know, from that alone and from the way he made guitar both rhythm and lead instrument in rock and roll, you know, a significant accomplishment. And, you know, if you talk about the Beatles and the Stones and the Beach Boys and everything that followed, you know, the Ramones, Kraftwerk, the German synthesizer band, was trying to do Chuck Berry songs on a Moog synthesizer and succeeding. You know, Berry wrote about tooling around St. Louis, and they wrote about driving on the Autobahn. So, you know, the model is so basic that we forget it. But also the idea that two other things, that, you know, he was an auteur. He wrote his own material. The blues greats that recorded at that same studio, 2120 South Michigan, you know, were recording songs by Willie Dixon, you know, or traditional songs. You know, Chuck was writing and performing and recording his own material. So there was that model 10 years before it would become standard for the Beach Boys and the Beatles. And finally, there's the lyrics. You know, the idea that this is a generational music, and you may not understand it. Roll over, Beethoven. This is not for you. This is something new. The old folks can tell. You never can tell. You know what I mean? C'est la vie, say the old folks. You never can tell. Old folks. No, that's not us. We're a new generation. We have a new sound.
Yeah.
And this is the sound.
Well, I guess so. And, you know, not having been there during the transformation, I guess it's hard for me to today imagine it as transformative or disruptive, because we sort of take it for granted. This is what rock and roll sounds like. The guitarist
yeah.
the lead, and Chuck Berry's this guy
well,
who had something
you know,
to do with
I,
it.
I teach a course at Columbia College for 200 freshmen called Music and Media in Chicago, and we look at the music recorded here and some of the media greats. And when I play them Chuck Berry, they're shocked. In their head, it's Happy Days, nostalgia music, right? But I play them a performance clip of Roll Over Beethoven, and the wink and the leer and the kind of postmodern, we are conspiring together. Chuck is dangerous and sexy and conspiratorial. And he scares them a little bit, which is makes me very happy for an 18-year-old today raised on the Wu-Tang Clan to be frightened a little bit, see
yeah.
a little bit of that frisson that first generation rock and roll had, because we clean it up and we sanitize it. And Chuck Berry was electrifying. And, you know, for an African-American man to be doing this in the mid-50s, and his period continued after he had some problems, he was still pretty great through much of the 60s when he came back from prison after serving for the Mann Act, bringing teenage girls. Sweet little 16, a little too close to truth for Chuck.
Right.
Almost a little R. Kelly there, later a
I'll talk to you about that in just a second, but then one other question just about his making rock and roll what it is today, or
sure.
or maybe being one of the pillars. Was his greatest gift then that vision, or, you know, that he had a different idea for music, or was it his craftsmanship? Was he just such a great guitar player that people were going to follow wherever he led, you know?
I think it's all of the above. All of the above and more. He was also an incredible showman. You know,
yeah.
that duck walk and the onstage performance and his entire persona. And it was a little gangster, you know. It was gangster rap, you know, 4 decades before. Chuck would infamously walk into a venue and refuse to perform a note with a pickup band who he never met and expected to know his songs without getting paid in a suitcase full of cash. It was cash only,
yeah.
and it was pay me now or I walk.
Yeah,
you know?
Which got him into trouble. Let's just talk a little bit about his personal life. He was born in St. Louis. He obviously finally found his way to Chicago, but why was he always running afoul of the law? He had 3 tours in jail.
I think partly it was the times. For an African-American man to be as successful, as wealthy, as celebrated, as famous as he was, I wrote a book about the rock critic Lester Bangs, who really was the second generation of rock critics. And, you know, there was no serious writing, John, about rock and roll for its entire first decade. It was not until Sgt. Pepper in 67. But none of the music of the 50s was written about seriously. There were two kinds of writing. There were fan magazines that published the lyrics
yeah.
And pictures, but only for the white artists, not the black artists, not Little Richard and not Berry, not Bo Diddley, Elvis. And then there were, you know, newspaper stories that said this was, juvenile delinquent scourge. So this music wasn't taken seriously as a cultural force at the time, which was probably a good thing. It made it all the more our secret. You know, this is ours.
Right.
So I think he was a target. I think he had a target on his back for police officers.
Well, what happened with this Mann Act thing? So what was his relationship like with that 14-year-old girl?
There were groupies that he was transporting across state lines, putting on his tour bus.
So what happened on the tour bus?
What do you mean? He was having his way with an underage girl.
I mean, that's statutory then, right?
Yeah. But I don't know if they could prove that. I think they only proved the Mann Act that he had brought her across state lines.
Well, in that case, that could have gone a lot worse for him. Today,
yeah.
he would not be out of jail.
There are a lot of people who apologize for the groupie culture. I'm not one of them, because there's a power discrepancy. It's not much different than a high school teacher. You know, there's that case going on right now in Tennessee.
Sure.
High school teacher bringing a freshman, running away with it, right? I think more troubling is later in life, in the last decade and a half. You know, he paid more than $100 million to people who sued him. He had installed video cameras in the bathrooms of his restaurant to film women going about their business. That's disturbing. You know, Chuck was not a nice man.
Yeah. Maybe that's the way geniuses come, packaged with all of these sorts of conflicts and contradictions. But did you say $100 million?
Yeah, I believe it was like $112 million.
He made that much money in his career, or generated that much revenue.
Yeah, because he was smart. I think, unlike others, he was able to hold on to it. That pay me in cash in the suitcase up front thing. Whether he ever managed to collect from Chess, the famous Cadillac Records label, we'll buy you a car, but we're not going to pay you your royalties, I don't know. You know, there's a lot of different, there are different takes on the history of Chess Records.
Huh. What about the My Ding-a-ling song?
Yeah, well, late in his career, he's phoning that in. I think you have to.
But that was his biggest hit, right? I mean, at least on the, I believe that's the only song he had that went to number one.
Oh, no. There were, well, it depends on how you define number one. Let's remember that rock and roll was segregated for 15 years. Huh. You know, it was the R&B chart and colored music.
So that was him just like, I'll redo this song. I'll put Ding-a-ling instead of tambourine in. And
well, I prefer to think of it in the same lineage of, say, Prince's Little Red Corvette. Great songs about a woman's most sensitive organ.
And
we'll that's what it is, you know.
Well, I think I know what a ding-a-ling is, if that's what you're asking.
Yeah. And so, My Ding-a-ling, Little Red Corvette, okay, we get where okay, there you go. 50 years of R&B history condensed.
If I listen to two or three, then, Chuck Berry songs today, what should I listen to?
Well, you know, my colleague Greg Kot did a great job in the Tribune yesterday. He pointed out how Brown-Eyed Handsome Man, which is one of the early Chess hits, is really a song about race relations in America. You know, 10 years before Curtis Mayfield, say, is talking about that, or the Staple Singers. And it's a powerful song, or a song like Memphis. Or, you know, there are several pedal steel tracks that Chuck recorded with Willie Dixon at Chess Records. And you can hear that he's a virtuoso also on that instrument. But really, you know, the single album to own is called The Great 28, and that's what it is. It's 28 songs that are the one-stop shopping history of the foundation of rock and roll, and they're all brilliant, and, you know, everything from the Ramones to Green Day to all modern rock comes from that.
Born in 1926, died March 18th, 2017, Charles Edward Anderson Chuck Berry. Jim, I just wanted to ask you a couple questions about South by Southwest. Do you have one more minute?
Yeah, of course.
Stay right there. This is WGN. 1:52. Jim DeRogatis gives us a couple more minutes on this, the first day of spring. I'm going to have to play I Wish You Bluebirds in the Spring after the 2 o'clock news, but right now it's
deep down in Louisiana, close to New Orleans, way back up in the woods among the evergreens. There stood a log cabin made of earth and wood, where lived a country boy named Johnny B. Good, who never ever learned to read or write so well, but he could play a guitar just like a ring in a bell. Go, go!
So we go from Chuck Berry sound, although that really is a lot of fun. You know, it happens whenever somebody passes away. Jim, I suddenly remember, oh, yeah, I love that music, or, wow, that's a lot of fun. I should have paid more attention to that music, you know?
Well, the music's immortal. That's the thing. I saw Neil deGrasse Tyson tweeting about how, reminding us that Berry's Johnny B. Good was one of the songs that was shot into space on a cassette.
I didn't know that. Go humanity!
Yeah. So, I mean, if you got to tell a distant alien civilization what's best about this world, you'd be hard pressed to find something else to do it in 2.5 minutes.
As citizens, as earthlings, each and every one of us should pause and ask ourselves if we're making a contribution so great to civilization that we would actually launch it into space for future civilizations to discover and say, yeah, well, we got that.
Yeah.
I haven't done that yet.
Top that, Mars. Fear, maybe. I don't know. Not in 2.5 minutes.
Here's you writing about South by Southwest. I thought it was kind of funny. You wrote, the tenor of South by Southwest 2017 can be gleaned from the way it's now described in its official corporate lingo. Quote, the South by Southwest trademark, South by Southwest trademark, conference and festivals celebrate the convergence of interactive film and music industries, March 10th through 19th, 2017. You wrote, in my 26 years as a journalist and critic covering America's best celebration of independent music, this was the first time when music almost seemed like an afterthought.
Yeah, well, it did to the conference organizers, and certainly it does to the brands. You know, since there is no longer a music industry of the sort that launched Chuck Berry, labels like Chess Records, you know, it is now, we had Nile Rodgers, the great super producer and member of Chic, as the keynote address, talking about how the future is with brands. And bragging about how he, you know, happily works with Nike and luxury automobile companies. You know, I don't think that's why Chuck Berry wrote his music. He was very happy to get paid for it. Obviously very mercenary. But, you know, it comes from a place of art. And it's always a bucket of ice water in the face, John. You know, you go to these panels all day where you have people scheming about how to best market music as an accoutrement to your urban consumer lifestyle. And then there are 2,000 bands that have traveled from around the world on their own dime, hoping to get heard. I saw a young surf band from Peru. You know, these kids were 25, and they stripped down to their swim trunks and played this amazing set of very 2020 futuristic surf, but drawing on the Beach Boys and the Ventures, and it was, you know, it's phenomenal. So the music always leaves me extremely uplifted while I come home a little sick to my stomach about the industry that sells it.
I got less than 60 seconds left, but what's the name of that band?
Mundaka, M-U-N-D-A-K-A. Yes.
In your column, you wrote a piece about some of the music that did inspire you, and I have to tell you, I laughed out loud at the name of one of the groups.
Let's Eat Grandma?
Yes!
They sound nothing like that. We're talking about two teenage British women who make this incredibly Spartan, minimalist, beautiful pop music.
Oh, okay. Yeah, because I thought
there's got to be a story there, and I'll interview them on Sound Opinions, and we'll get it.
Yeah, no kidding. I wonder how the grandma feels about that. I mean, how did somebody not take that name already? It's so awesome. Let's Eat Grandma.
Let's Eat Grandma.
Is the name of the band. Give me one other band name that maybe I should surf for to listen to that was at South by Southwest.
Oh, I saw this wonderful kind of combination of Easter Mass and Satanic Ritual by a Los Angeles musician named Sorn, S-O-R-N-E.
Yeah, right.
And that was cool. I needed a little of that.
Read him in the Sun-Times.
Not anymore. No, it's been 7.5 years since I left the Sun-Times.
Pardon me, I need to take that off your resume, don't I?
There you go. Sound Opinions on WBEZ.
Thanks a lot, Jim, for your time.
You betcha.
Jim DeRogatis, can you tell I've been away a little bit? It's 1:57. We always do Trump talk on this show as is necessary in the 2 o'clock hour. Otherwise, if you start, I'm afraid you never stop. So we reserve that conversation for 2 o'clock, and with the ongoing hearings today, we have a lot to say after the news. WGN, we're just figuring out which of these cuts to play from the hearings today, because as I was listening to them, one was just more fascinating than the other. But I still think maybe we should just replay the one that we played earlier, Elif, and that is when they were just starting to read President Trump's tweets from last month, or was it earlier this month? It was early in March when he said that Barack Obama had tapped his lines. And so, you know, the sort of $64 question is, at least to the two people that were testifying today, do you believe that there is any evidence to support that?
I want to begin by attempting to put to rest several claims made by the president about his predecessor, namely that President Obama wiretapped his phones. So that we can be precise, I want to refer you to exactly what the president said and ask you whether there is any truth to it. First, the president claimed, quote, terrible. Just found out that Obama had my wires tapped in Trump Tower just before the victory. Nothing found. This is McCarthyism, unquote. Director Comey, was the president's statement that Obama had his wires tapped in Trump Tower a true statement?
With respect to the president's tweets about alleged wiretapping directed at him by the prior administration, I have no information that supports those tweets, and we have looked carefully inside the FBI. The Department of Justice has asked me to share with you that the answer is the same for the Department of Justice and all its components. The department has no information that supports those tweets.
The president accused Mr. Obama and presumably the FBI of engaging in McCarthyism. As you understand the term McCarthyism, do you think President Obama or the FBI was engaged in such conduct?
I'm not going to try and characterize the tweets themselves. All I can tell you is we have no information that supports them.
Were you engaged in McCarthyism, Director Comey?
Try very hard not to engage in any isms of any kind. Including McCarthyism.
Sometimes they need a light moment, and so there was that one between Schiff and Comey. Lana Zak joins us now, Capitol Hill correspondent for ABC News. Lana, it's John Williams, and you're on WGN. How are you?
I'm great, John. What a busy day we have been having here at the Capitol. And so many lawmakers were very interested in hearing from James Comey, the director of the FBI. You know, the topic of this hearing was really supposed to be about those Russian connections, those allegations of Russian interference in the U.S. election. And that played a part of it. But it was so interesting, especially in that section that you just played, how it seemed for Republicans and Democrats almost like there were two different hearings. For Democrats, they really wanted once and for all for it to go on the record that the president was not presenting truthful information when he sent out those tweets about President Obama engaging in illegal wiretapping. And we've already heard that now from half a dozen Republicans, as well as basically every Democrat. So to hear it from the FBI director himself, that was a very important moment for Democrats. But for Republicans, they really, particularly Trey Gowdy, who's best known for his involvement in chairing those Benghazi hearings, he really wanted to go into what the president was tweeting about this morning, which were the legality of those leaks, saying that that for that information to have gotten out that got General Flynn fired as his position of national security advisor, that it was less important to him, it seemed, the content of what we learned from those leaks than the leaks themselves.
And the president's been tweeting that, and who wouldn't argue that that's not critical? I mean, Comey said as much. That's 10 years in jail, and it should be. He said this is a terrible thing if that's proven to be true. I'm a little confused, though, and I'm glad you're speaking to this, because you really do have two things here, don't you? Did, in fact, Barack Obama tap Donald Trump's lines? And then did the Russians hack the U.S. election? Is this investigation looking into both of those sorts of things?
Well, what we learned for the very first time, and usually, as I know you know, John, but maybe all listeners don't know, that it is not the procedure of the FBI to ever confirm an investigation that is going on. They don't like to talk about it. They feel like it compromises the integrity of that investigation. So it is a big headline today that he confirmed that there is, in fact, an active investigation going on now into any potential ties between the Trump administration and his team and the Russian government in terms of trying to sway the election. Comey said that it was obvious from their intelligence that Vladimir Putin, the president of Russia, hated Hillary Clinton, wanted to make sure that Secretary Clinton lost. He wouldn't go so far as to say that he was necessarily a proponent of the president, President Trump, but that he really did not like Hillary Clinton and that his efforts were focused on trying to undermine her administration.
Right.
Another thing that he said was that the Russians believed that Hillary Clinton was also going to win that election. So they were trying to sow discord in her in what they thought was going to be her administration.
That was a funny part of the conversation, because the Republicans on the panel were trying to make the point that doesn't mean that Trump and Putin like each other. That simply means, I mean, so what does that mean? If the Russians are working to defeat Hillary Clinton, does that mean the Russians like Donald Trump? And then we say, aha, see, I told you they were in cahoots.
And that's exactly right, John. That was, and Republicans also wanted to make sure that it was also on the record, absolutely clear, that when we're talking about Russian interference in the election, it didn't mean that the Russians were hacking into the voting machines, changing tallies, that they did anything that changed the votes that were cast as they were cast, but that the allegation is, in fact, that they interfered in a PR sort of way that caused people to distrust Hillary Clinton and her administration in an attempt to undermine her.
But I want to go back to, indeed, but I want to go back to that point, too. That is, I think it's a fair point to remind ourselves of, just because the Russians may have hacked the election and that may have aided Donald Trump, it doesn't mean that there's a link between Trump and the Russians or even that the Russians like Trump. It simply means if their first objective is no Hillary Clinton, then they'll support anybody. Zippy the squirrel gets their help. But in this case, it happens to be Donald Trump. But that doesn't mean that Trump and the Russians were colluding. It simply means they wanted anybody but Donald.
And I think that's why when
anybody but Hillary
was asked, right? Yes, when the FBI director was asked if Vladimir Putin was supporting Donald Trump's candidacy for president, that Comey declined to answer that part of it.
Yeah.
Instead phrasing it specifically as as you're pointing out, that he disliked Hillary Clinton. He had interacted with her previously in her role as Secretary of State. He did not care for her, and he wanted to undermine her.
It was an interesting way to put it, too. They described it as a basketball game. Everybody's got their brackets. And he said, if you have a team, then you are going to root against the other team. It doesn't mean that you, like or dislike one team or another, but simply that you, well, I guess it does, but it doesn't mean you like that one team. It's just you want this first team to lose. And now that other team is your favorite team because they might beat them.
And a lot of time was spent discussing sports for that analogy. And I think that's exactly how the FBI director wanted to draw that line. That said, it doesn't make it any less. Let me put it as technically as Comey did, but it doesn't make it just because you like the business interest, which is one of the things that came up, just because you like the candidate Trump's position on the Ukraine, on Russian oil, some of those other things, doesn't mean that there was actual collusion. But he wouldn't go into any details of the investigation. So Democrats are still sort of salivating to see what other smoking guns may or may not be there. And given that this was a public forum, given that this was really highly unusual in many ways to have this sort of discussion open to the media, that there are other parts of this investigation that the FBI director said he would be happy to discuss with those members of Congress privately in a secret or classified setting.
Capitol Hill correspondent for ABC, Lana Zak, is on the line. So the headlines today are that, yes, they did admit that there is an investigation going on between the hack. I think we all knew that. And also that there is no evidence to support that Barack Obama tapped Donald Trump. Is there an investigation per se into that, though?
It sounded like he had already drawn the conclusions. He said that both from the perspective of the FBI and the Justice Department, and in his position of authority, not only was it unlikely that it could have happened, but that the President Obama did not have the authority to make that happen. And he doesn't need to do a full investigation. He knows, as the director of the FBI, whether or not his department was involved in an illegal wiretap of Trump Tower. And so he sort of definitively said outright that didn't happen.
But he's not supposed to say if there was a FISA investigation, right?
No, and he would not answer any questions about that. He wouldn't answer any questions about whether or not the President Obama had asked and been denied a request to surveil Trump Tower or any of President Trump's associates. So, and he said, please don't read anything into what I will or will not say on that subject, because I am not going to answer any questions and give you any indication on that, because it's not for the public realm.
And I'm not speaking now about the possible Russian hack of the U.S. election. That is literally hacking into the Democratic National Committee and the RNC, for that matter. I mean, they were hacked as well. So maybe they were covering their bases, but they were talking about whether or not there was an investigation into the Barack Obama campaign or the president ordering a tap of Donald Trump. And many, many times he would say, I'm not even going to answer that because if I say yes or no in some instances, then you'll begin to infer things that we just don't want you to infer. We're not going to go down that road with you guys. So the president was then tweeting this morning at 5:35 a.m. He tweeted the following. James Clapper and others stated that there is no evidence POTUS colluded with Russia. This story is fake news and everyone knows it. So that's him denying the I don't know what he's denying there, that the Russians helped the Republicans, right?
Well, you know, part of what has actually worked for President Trump has been to have this be a very muddy a muddy bit of water.
Yeah.
And so I think you're not alone in trying to understand what exactly the president is saying in that, because there are so many things in there.
Well, let me just insert a second tweet after that. 14 minutes later at 5:49 a.m., the president tweeted, "The Democrats made up and pushed the Russian story as an excuse for running a terrible campaign. Big advantage in Electoral College and lost." But that's not what James Comey is saying. He said, no, there's sufficient reason to launch a full-scale investigation of this. He doesn't see that as just a lie by Hillary Clinton's people.
That's right. And that's, I think, part of what gets lost as we're talking about whether or not President Obama was involved in wiretapping Trump Towers or how this information was leaked, and whether or not James Clapper or the former attorney general or the former acting attorney general or any of the number of people that Senator Trey Gowdy listed during this hearing today were the people behind that. Fundamentally, what Comey was trying to communicate was that that Russia is an adversary of the United States. They would like to see the United States be weakened. They would like to see the administration be weakened, and that their objective, first and foremost, was to sow discord and distrust in our democratic systems. And on that front, it seems like even us having this conversation right now, John, indicates that they were successful in doing that.
Lana, I've got some really good questions from some listeners. Will you take a couple of quick questions from our audience?
Yes.
Okay. Stay right there. It's 2:21. We'll do that next on WGN.
Third, the president stated, "I bet a good lawyer could make a great case out of the fact that President Obama was tapping my phones in October just prior to the election." Director Comey, you're a good lawyer. Can you make out a great case that President Obama wiretapped Mr. Trump's phones just prior to the election, in light of the fact you have said there's no evidence of that?
All I can say is what I said before, that we don't have any information that supports those tweets.
Which is kind of how he answered almost everything. Lana Zak is a Capitol Hill correspondent for ABC. She's joining us on WGN. This is John Williams. Lana, we'll pick up a couple of phone lines unless you have something to say to that exchange right there.
No, let's get right to the questions.
We'll start with Joe. You're on WGN. Go ahead, Joe. You're on the air.
Hi, John. Hi. I just had a question about the issue that Donald Trump, obviously, has been proven that he didn't get tapped by Obama. And the consensus is that he said it to divert attention from the Russian issue. Now, if they've proven or if they prove that he did, in fact, lie about it, what do they do to the president?
What are the repercussions for him? That's an interesting question. Do we know?
Well, you know, we were waiting to see how far the FBI director would go, whether he would say that the record needed to be corrected. In terms of actual sanctioning the president for those tweets, the White House has been sort of trying to make a case that the president was describing wiretapping more generally, because two of those four tweets had quotation marks around wiretap and wiretapping, indicating that it meant surveillance more generally. And so it's unlikely two things. One, it's unlikely that the president is going to face any negative repercussions for that in any formal sense. And it's also unlikely that that the White House is going to formally apologize or back off of that statement.
He puts quotes around a lot of things, and it makes no sense when he does. There's no rhyme or reason to it. I think the quotes just fell into this. He sometimes uses it for emphasis, and sometimes it actually works against the content, grammatically speaking, of what he's trying to do. Here's my opinion about it. Thanks for asking, Lana. If anybody thinks that he broke the law or there should be some then penalty for the president, this whole thing is a waste of time. Let's go ahead and have these hearings, figure this thing out, but then let's not further waste everybody else's time by trying to punish the president. You know what I mean? Let's just move past this as quickly as we can. Let's pick up a phone line then with Barbara on line two. Hey, Barbara, you're on the air. What do you want to say?
I don't remember the right acronym for it, but this morning on the news, Senator Paul said that two of these special investigations that have to go in front of a special judiciary board had been initiated by the Obama administration. One was denied, and the other, he didn't know if it was still in process or not. Do you know anything about it? And I'm sorry, I want to say that they're called FISLs.
FISA, F-I-S-A, yeah. Lana, do you know what she's talking about there?
Sorry, I wasn't sure I fully understood the question. Could you say that again?
Well, Comey has said that no FISAs would not respond to the question about FISAs, but Senator Paul, on this morning's news, said that two of those had been submitted and one was denied and he didn't know the status of the other.
Right, but that sounds to me like some of that right-wing reporting where people are reporting on the reporting that there were these FISA petitions that were denied. But I don't know that we understand. I don't know that anybody is acknowledging that, in fact, that's what happened, Lana. They did address that and said they can't talk about it.
Right. That's exactly right, John. And the caller is absolutely right that there is a lot of things being alleged right now and by people in positions of authority, and a lot of times they're not saying where they're getting this information from. The person who could speak most to that with the most authority was the FBI Director James Comey today, and he said he would not allow his department to comment on whether or not any of those requests were in
I wonder if the president is sitting there going, hokey smokes, look what I started. It was just me, you know, playing on my Twitter thing, saying crazy stuff. And now we've got a full-scale investigation, and this thing isn't slowing down. I wonder if he had any idea the magnitude of what he was about to launch when he did that.
I think sometimes those tweets go out. It's something that he saw on television or on the internet, and he's immediately responding to it. And it's always sort of led to an interesting bit of theater between the White House as they then try and interpret the president's remarks in a way that is palpable to the rest of America.
I'm keeping you longer than I'm supposed to. Lana, I'll let you run. Thank you so much for your time and expertise.
So great to talk to you, John.
Lana Zak is the Capitol Hill reporter for ABC. I know that Ann wanted to know if the president could be sued for defamation. I think that was your question, Ann, and I don't know the answer to that. I'm guessing not. I'm guessing that President Obama is too famous and President Trump has too much, you know, by virtue of his position, has the ability to do things the rest of us don't. I'll bet you there's not going to be a defamation suit. But I'm not 100% sure about that. It's 2:30. I know the news is next on WGN. WGN, this is John Williams. So did you watch the games over the weekend? It's the law, you know. You're supposed to. Did you watch the Northwestern game, Kim? Did you get upset at that last shot?
I did. That was a real bummer.
Do you blame the coach for running onto the floor?
No, he saw it. I mean, I would have done the same thing.
I didn't ask you if you saw it. I asked you if you blame the coach for doing it.
No, I don't.
He was so excited.
He loved his team.
I know.
And it really would have made a difference.
Yeah. Well, what made it worse was running on the floor.
Yeah, true.
But I don't want to do that. Mark Carman joins us now to talk a little bit about this. Hey, Mark, it's John. How are you this afternoon?
Do you want me to do that for you, John? Because I'm uncomfortable doing that.
Running onto the floor?
That too.
Oh, no. No. But saying I don't mean to blame the coach for that. I mean, do you blame the coach for doing it? What's your take on that play?
Well, I think I'm right with you here.
Well, first I should describe the play. Hold on a second. So in the and I'm sure you know what we're talking about. In the Gonzaga game, Northwestern, late in the game, their guy goaltends. I mean, sometimes goaltending is hard to tell because was it on the rim or not. But in this case, if you put your hand through the rim and come out the other side, that's pretty easy to call. They have 27 guys officiating these games. Not one of them saw it. The play goes the other way. The coach is so insane about it. Everybody runs onto the floor. He gets teed up. So we lose the 2 points on our end, and then we give them the ball and free throws on the other end. Okay, Mark, now what?
Well, it was an enormous play, and I don't know if Northwestern would have won the game, but they had a markedly better chance to win it. I think everybody would agree with that. I am kind of amazed that somebody who is in that position, who's refereeing a round of 32 game,
yeah.
You would think that those level skill of eyes, if you will, would see that somebody stuck a hand through the rim. But none of them did, and that's disappointing. Chris Collins certainly did. I think with Chris, what you love about him is his passion, his excitement, and that he's all in. And so somebody like that is not going to change his spots in the biggest moment in the history of the program.
Right. Well, but and, okay. Yeah. But I mean, but even look, nobody wants to win that game more than Collins, but the officials don't want to get it wrong either. I mean, there's no reason for the official to get that call that glaringly wrong. So why don't we have a system then where late in a game like this, at least in the tournament, the coaches have one of those plays where they can ask for a further review? I mean, a lot of sports now, late in games, especially important games, allow for some sort of review. Is there no opportunity to look at that and see?
I agree with you. Let's bring it in. You can throw the, whatever you want to call it, have your own yellow flag handkerchief that Collins can throw there. If he thinks that a ball is goaltended, we can go look at it. Is it on the way down? Is it going up? We can have it for out of bounds place. Who was it tipped off of? All that type of stuff. Now they have it in the final 2 minutes where they can review out of bounds plays or who was the ball off of. We see that, right? They don't have it for goaltending. So maybe that should be something that could be added.
Wait a minute.
In.
Wait
I would
a minute.
Agree.
Hold on a second. Are you saying that if that was an out of bounds, if the question was the ball out of bounds or was the player out of bounds, they could have stopped on their own. The official said, okay, we're not sure. They can do that on an out of bounds play, but they can't do it on a goaltending play?
Correct. I mean, there was a play right after that, I believe, where the ball was either off of Stanley Lumpkin or one of the Gonzaga players. I forget which one. And they looked at it for forever, and they finally gave it to Northwestern. I thought it was obvious. So, yeah, they can review the ball out of bounds.
Well,
they
then why
have it for go-
Well, when I get to be king, Carmen, Mark, they're going that will be added to the list because that's generally something you can pretty clearly tell. Certainly, in this case, it would have been quite obvious. His hand went through the rim, but did the guy's hand touch the rim? That also would have been goaltending. Did they interfere with the ball when it's in the cylinder? You can make a pretty clear judgment on that one.
Right. You're not allowed to touch the net either or any part of the basket. So, you know, that would have been – listen, I King John, I thought you were already king, but
no.
When you are, I guess, in this case, actually king,
yeah.
I think what we should add in is the egregious human error rule. You know, and let it be broad where it's not just for goaltending or for out of bounds. It could be something like a guy that took 10 steps and for whatever reason they didn't call the travel.
Well, okay. But how is it then late in the game, how is it determined that they are in fact going to stop play for a second and look to see if they got the call right? Now, they can't do it on goaltending, but suppose they did want to. Is it only at the insistence of one of the coaches? Does he have to persuade them in real time? Does he literally have to blow up and go, no, you guys, please look at that again? Or it's completely at the discretion of the officials, right?
Well, most times it's going to be the referees are just going to know that we're not sure we're going to go look at it. But you can ask, and the referees can be like, okay, we'll look at it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the referees can do it on their own, and certainly asking is they're not automatically going to grant it. It's not like you, you know, it's not like you have X amount of challenges like the NFL is automatically look at it.
Right, but here's the problem with my theory. So suppose in that case they it's not goaltending and they rip it off the rim legally, you know, that they just get a great rebound and off they go, fast break the other way. All you got to do is say, hey, I think that was goaltending, stop the play, and then it freezes their offense maybe when they have the advantage. That wouldn't be fair to them.
Right, but so to fix that rule to make it work for me, and I think you'll be on board here, John, you can throw that flag, but that flag or whatever you want to call you're throwing out there, the handkerchief, the John Williams handkerchief, it is not actually reviewed until play has stopped, until there is a dead ball. And at that point, it'll be reviewed.
Okay, but that could be several scores or plays. That could be a lot of action, right, that would take place.
Well, I suppose that's possible.
You could stop it after a score.
You could stop it after a score or, you know, in that scenario, like Chris Collins could just simply call timeout. I want you to look at this right now. So, but yeah, stop it after a score,
or you get possession because you can't call timeout when they have the ball. But then if it's determined that it was that you were right, if Chris Collins is right, it was goaltending, then you'd have to put the time back on the clock, and everything that happened from that point would then not count. We would have to play everything over, starting with the goaltend, right?
Right, right. I don't think it's that difficult. I mean, everything in life has to – there's always a gazillion complications, but I think this is pretty straightforward, and that's how it should be.
All right. Stay right there, Mark Harmon. I just wanted to see if – do you agree we should have something like this? In baseball, my attitude is we don't need replay as much as we already have it because 172 games and 7-game series are enough to determine the winner. If you all are so close, the one bad call determines – the outcome of a game or a series, then, frankly, you are pretty much even as it is. I just don't think there's any great injustice in baseball, even though they use it. But in a game like this, where it's one and done, it's a 64-team field, it's basketball, it's real time, I think you should have something like that. So here's your chance to agree with me, 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. I'm John. Carm's on the line. This is GN. We're talking to our sports guy here a little bit about the NCAA basketball tournament, the fact that Northwestern lost to Gonzaga, and that a critical play late in the game was goaltending that wasn't called by them against us. So Carm and I are on board with some sort of replay option that the coach could exercise so that that play would be reviewed and justice would be restored. Mark, I'm going to pick up a phone line or two here. We'll start with Dave. Dave, you're on the air. What do you want to say? Hi.
Hi. I disagree. I think these games take way too long as it is right now. I think there's so many plays that determine the outcome. I mean, if we weren't talking about big-time gambling and money, do you think anybody really give a crap about whether we had a replay or not?
Wow. Hadn't thought about that. You think that actually, I mean, that's not my interest, but I see your point, that too much money is on the line.
I said, correct. That's all it is. I mean, John, I mean, why did football go to it? Because it's a big-time gambling deal. I mean, I think the whole point of sports was learning how to deal with things when things don't go your way.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, and all those coaches are well compensated, and they knew what they were getting into long before they took that job.
I think that's why they lose their minds when stuff goes badly for them, especially in a case like this.
Yeah, well, how about if they learned how to lose their mind when they lost their job and they're trying to feed four kids at home, you know, and they're not getting $1 million or $2 million a year?
So you don't have any sympathy for Coach Collins when he runs onto the floor like that?
No. The whole team is looking to him as the leader, and you have to keep yourself under control. You don't think all those coaches are getting wound up? I mean, the team takes their cue from you.
The Wichita State coach's wife was so angry that they actually almost threw her out of the stadium. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's kind of funny. You know, we're talking about the same – hey, do we not have the same feelings about the current president of the United States doing things that we don't think are presidential?
Wow, I didn't think I had to try and manage these two. That's way too much for my little brain to try and figure out.
My point is it's leadership. Leadership, and I mean, we know what it is going into it.
Grow up
and act like an adult. It's a game, for heaven's sakes.
I'm glad you called, Dave. Thanks for calling.
Yep.
Have a good day. What do you say about that, Carm?
I don't get it, to be honest. I mean, what does Dave have against getting the call right? And college basketball, as far as length of games go, it's really one of the shorter experiences you have. I mean, college football is twice the time length I mean, a college basketball game is 2 hours, pretty crisp.
Yeah.
So,
But the end of a college basketball game is the dregs. Kim and I were talking about this at the beginning of the show. Those of us that love the game love the art. We love the flow of it. We love everything about it. And then something happens to basketball games, especially college basketball games late in the game, NBA games too for that matter, and that is they become tackle football with free throw shooting contests after each down. There were some plays in the Duke game last night that were just stunningly physical, and they didn't call it. And then sometimes they would, of course, and then you stop and shoot free throws, and you've got this fast-paced sort of poetry in motion going on that a good basketball game can be, and then it just becomes a rugby match, and I hate that about basketball.
I mean, I get that the end of games do take longer. Unless you're going to make everything free throws and you get the ball, you're not going to get rid of that.
Oh, that'd be interesting.
I mean, I get it.
Oh, that'd be interesting. That would eliminate the problem right there, wouldn't it? At least the hack-a-shack sort of stuff. I mean, there'd be no reason to foul then, would there?
Right. I mean, if you're not fouled in the act of shooting, one free throw and the ball, okay. But, that's part of the deal down the stretch. You got to make your free throws. Earn your way to the finish line.
Did you see, by the way, about that Wichita State coach, I forget his name. You'd recognize him. You know the guy I'm talking about. His wife was in the stands.
Yeah.
And three different times the security had to come up to her. And they were finally going to just throw her out. But then they thought, that'll look bad. She's the coach's wife. And we get it. But lady, you've got to cut it out. I believe they let her stay. But if it was anybody else, they would have been removed.
Right. Well, listen, people do end up putting their entire status as a human being on the line in a basketball game. If their kid's playing, if their husband's coaching the team, and they get wrapped up in the moment. And to the prior caller's point, yeah, it'd be ideal or better, or it should be, that people do realize that this is just a game. But it's a lot different for somebody in the stands who's watching, by the way, than a coach who this is his profession.
Yeah.
But that skill is a skill that a lot of people have not learned, and it's super painful when you're watching a 10 or 11 year old playing. You got somebody, a parent watching, just losing their mind. That to me is like the worst case of it.
What's that?
Just, your 11-year-old's out there, and you got a mom or a dad who's screaming at the umpire. get a clue. You are causing problems for your son.
You're doing that
level.
Well, I think we've all been there and either seen that or done that. I guarantee you that my worst behavior as a athlete's parent was when my kid was younger rather than when he was competing when he was older. Incidentally, by the way, I got to let you go, Mark, but of all of the brackets on Bleacher Report, NCAA.com, CBS, ESPN, Fox Sports, and Yahoo, none are perfect now. Nobody has a perfect bracket.
It's unfortunate that I didn't submit mine to one of those five, John. If I had, I'd be the one outlier.
Trust me, you're an outlier. That's Mark Carman. Thanks, Mark. I got to run. News is next. This is WGN. All right. See, I was just telling you guys, I don't think I know how. Okay, now wait a minute. You're on 2 and you're on 4. Hold
Hello?
On. There it is.
You got me.
God, this is so frightening.
Hello. I'm there. Yeah.
Hi.
And I'm All here. Right.
Welcome back. You kids look great.
Well,
especially you.
Thank you.
I'm not talking to him.
Not you, Ro.
No, I thought
He's
it was
talking
me.
Talking to me, my lovely tan that'll go away in a few days.
Yeah, but it looks good.
Thank you. We had a very nice time. It was the listeners were amazing. It was just such good spirits. I mean, everyone arrived. We were just, we didn't know what to expect, and then exceeded expectations. It was a beautiful piece of the world where we visited.
Yes, there's no question about that.
Flights good?
Flights were great. We flew Volaris, which was chartered by Apple, and it was lovely. I mean, everything was great. It was, uh, I, it, as Anna keeps saying, exceeded expectations beyond expectations. And given what the listeners paid for it, we won't discuss that anymore because it was the steal of the century.
Seriously, we weren't allowed to talk about it at the resort almost because a lot of people there paid a lot more than the WGN crew.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Well,
so,
good for us.
Yes,
good for them.
Exactly. Well, so if they're like, when are we doing it next? When are we doing it next?
Yeah, no kidding. Let's do a midday show one with my seven listeners. All right, here they go.